So you may remember from a few weeks ago on our show on Rule Breakers, we did this story about Susan Stern, who was a pretty famous revolutionary here in Seattle in the late 60s. She was a member of the Weather Underground and a high-profile activist in the anti-war movement. And as we were kind of getting that show up and running, my colleague Nick Morrison approached me in the hallway and asked about that segment. And Nick, maybe we can sort of recreate that conversation a little
bit. So I overhear you saying Susan Stern, and I say, do you mean Susan Stern the activist? You said, yeah. And I said, hey, she used to work for me as a stripper.
Nick, I know that you have held a number of different jobs. I know your path through life has not always been a linear one, but I hadn't realized that you had been in this industry in particular. And it got us thinking more about Vice and what Vice is and the history of it here in the Northwest, and the line between vice and virtue. And your piece of this contained, I think, a few surprises and some things that I think that people will be able to relate to better than they probably expected to.
Yes, well, I went into this expecting, maybe even hoping, to go into a deep den of vice and found it to be just another corner of the real world.
Yeah, well, we're going to hear all the twists and turns of this story coming up a little bit later on in the show. It's during our exploration of Vice right here on Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm your host, Gabriel Spitzer, and before we get into that, we have invited some friends over, as always, to catch us up on the week's news, so don't go away. Well, they have been called a trio of mouthy broads. Called that by themselves, actually. They are Hannah Brooks Olson, Alex Hudson, and Sarah Ann Lloyd. Together they make Seattle-ish, which is a blog about Seattle that's by turns boozy and wonky, that's foul-mouthed and earnest. Seattle-ish. Hey guys, welcome to Sound Effect.
Hi.
Hi.
So
Hi.
Do you have any sense of why we might have asked you here for a Vice show?
Is the boozy the part of it? The foul mouth?
You know, it could be wonky. I don't know. That's a Vice.
It is kind of a Vice.
Seattle politics. Definitely advice. All right, well, we're going to get to that in a moment. First, we're going to talk about our top story of the week, as well as our nominees for the most underreported story of the week and overreported story of the week. But for starters, our top story of the week, we are going to talk a little bit about city council elections because, man, the candidates are coming fast and furious, and I think we're starting to see the implications of the initiative that we voted in the last election that will implement district elections. So all of a sudden, instead of 9 at-large city council seats, we're going to have people representing individual neighborhoods. And Alex, maybe we can start with you. Have you been hearing about this? Are people talking about it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's a top-level conversation, certainly, for the work that I do. I think that people may not have realized kind of all the full implications of what it's going to be doing in terms of when we think about the federal government and this kind of horse trading of allocation of resources and all and everything that comes along with that, especially with certain departments within the city, that the serious implications that this has for how our city government is going to operate are really yet to be determined. I think it is nice to have a representative government that's really beholden to you. I think if you're an issues person, if you particularly care about a certain topic, bikes or schools, you used to be able to go and find, you know, your city council person who was the champion of that topic or issue, but you can't really do that anymore. You have to go to your person.
Yeah. Hannah Brooks Olson, have you been hearing this bubbling up? I mean, is this something you're paying attention to? We have almost, I think, over 30 candidates declared now.
Oh, absolutely. I'm really excited about the actual election process because of this conversation and this vote that we took in 2013, now we're looking at 2015, we might have all new city council members. Like, it might be an entire wash. Like, that probably isn't going to happen, but it's possible that after having years and decades of legacy city council members, we could have all new people trying to figure out how to run the city. And that to me is exciting and terrifying, and I think it's just going to be, I'm really excited about the whole process.
What do you think? Are you excited, Sarah, about the idea of a lot of turnover on the council, maybe seeing some old familiar faces off into the sunset and a lot of new blood there?
I am. I mean, especially with, I mean, I would want Licata to stick around theoretically, but since he has made that decision on his own, especially now, I would like to see a lot of turnaround there. I think that a lot of people maybe aren't excited about the map itself, but I think that that is kind of working out. I think it is encouraging a lot of newcomers to run, representing their neighborhoods, as opposed to having to contend with the whole city. And I think that's one reason why we do have such a high turnout, is because people are looking at their neighbors and saying, vote for me, as opposed to looking at the whole city and saying, vote for me.
Absolutely. And looking at people who have been in this in the position for 10, 15 years and saying like, oh, how am I going to run against that? You know, and especially I think after the last election with Shama Sawant running against someone, you know, Richard Conlon, who had been in that seat forever and seemed really unable to be toppled. And now, exactly right, like people are looking at their neighbors and looking at community activists and like socialist alternative candidates and members of the clergy are suddenly like, oh, I can handle this because it's just me against other people in my neighborhood.
Well, that's our top story this week, the district elections coming up for city council and beginning to understand how things could be a lot different looking in a couple of years on the council than they are now. But we also asked you guys to deliver your nominees for overreported story of the week, a story that you've had just about enough of. And Sarah Ann Lloyd, maybe we can start with you. What's your choice for that?
The local story that I chose was the texting while driving bill. I feel like, not texting, doing anything but texting while driving.
Right.
Sure, there needs to be a law about it, but I feel like most reasonable people don't want people watching YouTube videos on the freeway. And it's not really something that really is a controversy or a really huge story as much as it's just like patching some holes. Because I was just under the impression that you would get pulled over if you had your phone in your hand. And I think that was most people's understanding of the law. And now people know that they're like, no, officer, don't worry. I was just watching cat videos. I wasn't just like texting with one hand with one eye on the road or whatever.
So championing watching cat videos while driving. I'm going to go ahead and put you down for that, Sarah and Lord. It's your overreported story of the week. So Alex Hudson, what's your choice for overreported story?
The marijuana and the children. I am so tired of hearing about how legal marijuana is like, there was that story about how it's the number one bad act that all high school students do. And I was like, yeah, since like the 50s. Like, that's not new news. Teens love drugs, like for probably worse. But I think what's really missing from that story is how the unbelievable amount of tax that the state is collecting for marijuana sales is actually going into better, more comprehensive drug education and rehab. So it's not that we've just handed every, 16-year-old a pot brownie and called it a day. We're actually funding comprehensive drug education in this state. And so that's the real story. I guess I just think it's reefer madness and it's just totally boring.
All right. So overreported stories so far. We've homed in pretty tightly on the theme of this week, of course, on Vice. And you got another one, sort of, for your overreported story of the week, Hannah Brooks Olsen. What's your choice?
My overreported story this week was anything having to do with 50 Shades of Grey. Like, that movie came out. We all knew it was going to be garbage. I personally have like a real feminist issue, not because I have an issue with kink, but because I have an issue with rape culture. And there's a lot of real issues in that book where it doesn't actually represent, people with alternative sexual preferences. It really more sort of demonstrates actual like abuse, like relationship abuse. And then because theoretically the book takes place in Seattle, I guess everyone in Seattle has decided to try and like find a local angle. And so, there's posting pictures of the Escala building and talking about like, where would Christian Grey have gone to brunch? And it's like, oh my God.
So that's Hannah Brooks Olsen's overreported story of the week. Now, I would love to hear you guys as nominees for underreported story of the week. And maybe we could start with Sarah Ann Lloyd. What is your choice for underreported story?
So the Christopher Monfort trial is going on right now. The Seattle Times has kind of been on it, a couple other outlets, and I think a lot of aspects of it are really interesting, like the insanity defense, which I don't think a lot of people necessarily know is happening. The fact that it's a capital trial when we have a moratorium on the death penalty right now that may or may not outlast Jay Inslee, depending on what ends up happening over the next couple of years. And it's not like a closed press trial. There's information coming out of it, like with the jury being shown some really, really gruesome images of the case, and the other officer testifying soon and everything. I think that, there's a lot of really complicated context around it right now, obviously,
oh, yeah.
too, with the citizen and police relations right now.
Sure.
And everything. I think that it's a very, very underreported story. There have been like a couple of think pieces and a couple of just like general timeline pieces.
And a little burst of coverage when it first started, but then it quickly faded into underreported territory, you're saying?
Right.
So the ongoing Monford trial, your choice, Sarah Ann Lloyd, for underreported story of the week. And how about you, Alex Hudson? What's your underreported story?
So mine this week is the Seattle waterfront, which, I mean, most people would say, what are you talking about? That's a totally overreported story. But there was a huge, I mean, there's more to it than just Bertha and the seawall. And that was that there's a whole new office of the waterfront that was put in place by Murray when he first came in to deal with the kind of renovation and rejuvenation of the waterfront, which I think all Seattleites can agree is desperately needed. So one of the big plans was further connection with the downtown to the waterfront, because I think right now, you know, it's they're kind of hidden, weird, narrow, steep stairways that get you from First Avenue down to Alaskan Way. And there was this plan in place to build a really beautiful pedestrian walkway with an overview, and it was going to be really well labeled so people could kind of figure out how to get to and fro from there. And they just said that there's not enough funding, which I think is crazy. And I want to know more about where exactly that funding is then, because I imagine that it might be being thrown into a big hole down there.
A certain hole
that shall not be named. But I worry that at the end of whatever Horizon Day, when we finally finish whatever we plan to do down there, all we're going to get is a tunnel and a seawall.
Hannah Brooks Olson, what is your underreported story?
My underreported story this week is the new Youth Justice Center, or the I think they also call it the Family Youth Justice Center, but it's the child jail. It was a contract was approved this week by the King County Council unanimously to award the like $210 million, I think, contract to build a new youth justice center. We already have a youth justice center. It's old, and a lot of people have argued that maybe the building isn't in great shape, but it's also not full. It's only something like 60% full. So it's not like we're hurting for beds to jail children in at this time. But one of the most interesting things I think that really didn't get that much coverage was that during that hearing, a lot of activists came to King County Council and showed up because they didn't feel like they had ever had an adequate time to really talk about not just the construction of this jail, which was voted by voters in 2010, I think, or 2012. And one of the arguments is that voters didn't have a really clear idea on what they were actually voting on with this levy.
So you're saying that voters maybe didn't know what they were getting into?
That's one of the things that the activists have been talking about, is that this levy was voted on, and one of the things they're saying is that maybe people thought that they were voting for increased law enforcement, or maybe they thought they were voting for something more like family intervention or improved family services, when in fact what they're getting is just a giant building to house children.
Well, Hannah Brooks Olson, Alex Hudson, Sarah Ann Lloyd, the ladies of Seattle-ish, thank you guys so much for being on Sound
Effect. Yeah,
thanks for having us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this week we are thinking about vice, and we're kind of considering, you know, what's the line between virtue and vice, and how do we think about vice as a...
Wait a minute, Gabe?
What?
Yeah, well, if you're going to talk about vice, I want to hear about your own. Come on, tell us.
You're trying to just embarrass me in front of everybody? Or
be honest with your listeners.
All right. Oh, my gosh. This nosy person in our studio right now is KPLU's Ashley Gross, and since she's putting me on the spot, I mean, I don't know. My voices are pretty boring. You know, I've got... There are certain very mindless games that I get hooked on and on my mobile devices, and then I wind up playing them until ungodly hours of the morning, and that's something I have had a hard time kicking.
You gave up smoking. That's a really big deal.
Yeah. No, that was really difficult. I mean, that took several attempts for sure, and I'm not sure I'm totally out of the woods on it yet. I mean, smoking is one of those things that's just it's so woven into the fabric of your day. Like, there are reminders of it all over the place.
Right. But imagine what it would feel like if, you know, every ounce of your being was focused on that cigarette. Like, it was something that you thought about from the instant you woke up until you went to sleep. And then imagine what it would take to give it up. Well, I'm going to introduce you to a woman who is in recovery from meth. This was a drug that had completely taken over her life. I met up with her on a recent morning very early to catch a bus, and it was totally dark outside.
It comes at 6:02, but we can catch a little bit earlier one, and then we'll have to wait downtown.
Okay.
Sorry, so early.
No problem.
I know, sometimes I dread it. I've been up since 3:30.
Who is this?
This is Jan-Marie Dawson. And you know this, like getting up early, going to bed early, just having her act together, this would not have been possible 2 years ago. Her most recent addiction to meth lasted 3 years, and it robbed her of everything. Her job, her house, her car, and it almost robbed her of her relationship with her kids.
Route 132.
So what are you guys doing on a bus at this ungodly hour in the morning?
I went with her to her class at South Seattle College. She's learning to be a welder. And on the way, she was talking about the place that she just moved into. It's a subsidized apartment that's run by Catholic Community Services. And this is a woman who was homeless for a couple of years, and now she's able to furnish her own place.
I bought myself a big screen, flat screen TV, a 32-inch one for Christmas to myself. And I haven't been able to buy myself anything major like that for the last 5 years.
Is it part of, like, helping you stay clean, having a TV?
Yes, because I don't know what else to do with I would do with my time.
And is it that if you have that empty time, that's the scary thing, is having that empty time, that would be a temptation?
Yeah. I start thinking about it, yeah.
What she starts thinking about is getting high. And I talked with Kathy Spielman, who's been helping treat people with addictions for 30 years.
People that are using methamphetamine, there are actually changes that happen and impact them and their ability to feel pleasure and to feel good.
It sounds like it like changes your brain almost.
Yeah, she said it does change your brain, and it can take 14 months before you start getting over that depressed, flat feeling. But just like with any other addiction, that temptation is always there.
If we all think about behaviors that we may participate in our own lives that we don't, you know, at some point we say we want to change this. I don't want to do this anymore. And that isn't always a straight road.
Yeah, I feel like that's something a lot of us can probably relate to. I mean, changing a behavior or changing a bad habit is hard, even when it's a little thing. I mean, it's hard to imagine changing something that has just completely taken over your life, like meth.
Right. You know, and Jan Marie, she's wrestled with this drug for a good chunk of her life. I mean, it's a pretty heartbreaking story about how she got hooked. Her parents introduced her to drugs.
Oh, gosh, really?
Yeah. Well, her dad, she says, was a pharmacist, and he used to treat her and her sister almost like guinea pigs.
He would give us pills, or he'd have us smoke weed, PCP, just to see how the reaction was on us.
How old were you?
I was probably 10 on up.
I mean, hearing that, it's kind of remarkable that she's around to talk to us at all.
I agree. You know, she was an alcoholic by age 18, and she started using cocaine at 19 with her parents, and then she moved to meth.
Speed was always my big thing because it gave me energy. I like to be energized. I like to get up and go.
Jan-Marie was addicted for a good 15 years to meth. She had 2 kids while she was addicted. And then she wound up going to prison because her son tested positive for the drug when he was born. But after she got out of prison, she got clean and she got her life on track. She got a job as a secretary and she stayed clean for 10 years. But then, you know, she was working a lot. She had a second job and she started drinking now and then.
Started out once a month. Once a week, and then pretty soon it was every night, and then I was beginning to get drunk.
She moved on to meth, and everything fell apart.
I was on the verge of losing my job. And
so she quit.
I couldn't afford to pay the rent anymore. And
she and her boyfriend got evicted.
We just kind of wandered the streets. And
they slept in abandoned cars, or they'd stay up all night collecting scrap metal.
I was committing crimes to get it. I was stealing it.
All just to get money for meth. But even getting high wouldn't make her feel better.
I just cried and cried and cried and cried and cried, wishing that I had a way out, but I wasn't quite ready to quit.
What made her finally feel ready to quit?
It's not one thing. She got into some bike accidents that were pretty bad, but mostly it's just that she remembered her old life.
I just missed my life so bad. I missed being clean so bad that I just couldn't take it anymore.
So she did it. She quit. But even the night before she went into rehab, she went out for one last fix. That's how strong a hold the drug had on her. But listen to this. Here's the prize for getting clean.
Grandma, after you're done with school, can you kick me to Iris and Connor's house?
On Friday?
Jan-Marie is a grandmother.
I haven't seen you for days. Can I have a hug and a kiss? Oh.
Baby
Hulky. I haven't. Can I see your hamster?
I went with her to her daughter Lee Marie's house. Lee Marie says she didn't really believe her mom was going to get clean. It wasn't until she went to visit her at the rehab that it became real.
She was herself again. She wasn't on drugs. She wasn't tripping out. She was gaining weight. She was getting the color back in her face. Like, seeing her gain weight is actually really great because she was so bony and She was sick.
She was sick. And back when she was addicted, she was not always a good grandmother. She would sometimes get high when she was babysitting her granddaughter, Micaiah. And one time her daughter, Lee Marie, came home to discover Micaiah, who was about 2 years old, sitting there drinking meth water out of a bong. And Lee Marie took Micaiah to the doctor.
I didn't tell the doctor that it was meth water. I was scared. And my mom, she was like, just tell on me, just tell them it was me. And I was like, well, what if they take her from me? Because we were living in that environment. And so I just told them that I didn't know what was wrong with her. And she cried from like 6 p.m. to like 2 o'clock in the morning.
Gosh, that is really difficult to hear. I mean, it's hard to know even how to feel about that.
The way Jan Marie feels is she just feels a ton of regret. But she tries not to let that, you know, weigh her down. She focuses on the positive things that she's doing right now. And her family is really supportive. They are really excited that she's, you know, getting her life back together.
Grandma has your dress.
I have your dress. You want to see it?
Yeah.
Okay, come on, let's go. I am 50 years old, and I have a strong desire to just be clean for the rest of my life. I don't want the rest of my life to be miserable. I want to live a life that's happy and full of joy, and you can only have that when you're clean and sober.
It's really extraordinary. What was it like to talk to her? I mean, what did you kind of come away with this with?
I was just incredibly moved by how honest she was about it. I even asked her, why are you doing this interview? And she said she felt like maybe it would help other people, you know? She wanted to just show this example to other people who are out there struggling. And she knows that there's still a lot of hurdles for her to overcome. She says she doesn't have a lot of money right now. She's hoping she'll be able to get a welding job when she finishes up her program. Then, of course, she always faces that temptation of using again. That's always there. But there are so many things for her to feel proud of. I mean, just this past December, she sent out Christmas cards for the very first time in 5 years.
Well, Ashley, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you, Gabe.
KPLU's Ashley Gross brought us the story of Jan Marie Dawson, who is recovering from an addiction to meth. My colleague Nick Morrison has dabbled in a pretty seedy line of work. You know, it's a lot of depravity, a lot of kind of shady people. And I'm talking, of course, about public radio. But before he broke bad, Nick once used to manage a downtown Seattle strip club. Now, this was in the 1970s and, you know, a different era. I feel like maybe the statute of limitations has elapsed on having to moralize about it. And anyway, as it turns out, it was really a lot like any other workplace. So Nick joined us a few days ago to spin the tale.
I was a bartender in the public market in Post Alley, and the strippers used to come down and have after-work beers. And we developed relationships. They were a fun group, and they needed a manager and said, hey, you should talk to the guy who owns this place. You could come and be our manager.
Did you have any experience, relevant experience, in either managing a business or managing a den of iniquity?
No. None at all. In fact, I was pretty innocent.
So did that sound, I don't know, how did that sound to you?
It sounded intriguing, actually, because at that point, I still had it in mind to become a great American novelist. So go do that. You know, do the Nelson Algren thing.
So the New Paris Follies, what kind of place was this?
It was, at one point, a beautiful theater. There was a ticket booth out near the sidewalk where people bought their tickets. There were nice, lovely doors to go in, but they had all, you know, they were all kind of grungy by that time.
the lobby was nothing to speak of. It was dark. The carpets were sticky. You know, there were just vending machines. The music was incredible. There was a guy named Bruce Thomas who played the Hammond B3 organ for the women, and he was stunningly talented. He's actually a classical accordionist.
So wait, they would dance to a live musician who mm-hmm. happened to be a classical accordionist playing a Hammond organ?
Yep.
Wow.
Yeah.
So it wasn't like disco tracks off record or something like that.
No, in fact, he was like this great bonus. I'd get a stripper on stage and run around behind the stage and go watch Bruce play. So he was just phenomenal. And then there was Lloyd, who did the spotlights and ran the pornographic film strips between shows. And the reason he worked there was so he'd have time to work on articles for National Geographic. He submitted articles to National Geographic all the time, hoping to have one accepted.
Do you remember like your first day of work or what it was like at the beginning?
My job basically was just to keep the dames running on time. I basically just had to hire, fire, schedule the strippers. So I asked the man who ran the theater if he had any advice, and he said, keep your foot on their necks.
That doesn't strike me as something that's sort of in your nature, Nick.
It didn't strike me as something that was within my nature either. So I relaxed some of the standards.
So what kind of women worked there as dancers?
There was quite a handful of single moms. There was a woman who was a jewelry designer who couldn't make ends meet. There was a part-time university professor. It was really a broad mix of people. And there were a number of women who just saw it as a real easy way to make pretty good money.
And how did they treat you?
Well, as I said, they started abusing my good nature.
Oh. And they thought, oh, here comes some fresh meat.
Right, right. I was totally a patsy for these guys. And so, you know, once the standards were relaxed, I was getting these last-minute phone calls. You know, oh, Nikki, I can't make it. My mom can't take my kid. And so the way that I determined to solve that problem was to start a daycare. A daycare in a striptease theater, Gabriel.
I guess the real question there is, where do you put the daycare?
Well, the strippers' dressing rooms and this big open area were on the second floor of the building. And they came in, the dancers came in through a back door that really didn't interact with the theater at all. They'd go up some back stairs to the second floor, and they each had little dressing rooms, and there was a big open area. So I said, look, how about you bring your kids to work? As long as somebody's up there to watch your kid while you're dancing, how about that? And they thought it was a grand idea, even the women who didn't have children. And I guess the only leg I have to stand on there is that it was not uncommon to go up into the dressing room and see somebody sitting around with a Cosmopolitan magazine and a pint of Smirnoff waiting for the next show. It wasn't uncommon to see somebody snorting a snortable substance or smoking a joint. It didn't happen all the time, but it was not uncommon. When the kids came, everybody put their stuff away.
Huh. So your response to this den of vice was to clean it up by introducing a bunch of innocent young children.
I think it did a power of good for everybody. I mean, between shows, it's boring, you know, and very easy to indulge in your vice of choice. But when the kids came around, all the women fell in love with them. And I think they became a happier, more sober outfit because they all of a sudden had a responsibility.
So as you're thinking back on that stretch of your life and this particular chapter, I mean, what are the biggest feelings that you get? What are the strongest memories and the strongest kind of sense memories?
Well, the sense memory would probably be the smell of the theater. The other memories are all pretty warm. I mean, all in all, this was a wonderful bunch of people to work with. They were kind of rowdy, you know, kind of naughty, and a great deal of fun.
Do you feel like you learned anything from this experience?
If I had taken that man's advice and tried to put my foot on somebody's neck or on the necks of a group of people, I probably would have failed miserably and felt miserable the whole time. By going with my nature I was miserable for a short period of time, and then we all got on the same bus, and we were all, like, we all had more fun after that. So I guess be true to thyself.
Nick Morrison, KPLU's production director. Is that your title?
I like to think of myself as a morals coordinator and flux monitor around here.
And one-time skin merchant. Thank you so much, Nick.
Thank you.
You're listening to Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. We're talking about Vice this week. Hey, Ed Ronco.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm okay. I was wondering, do you have a Vice yourself?
Yes. For me, it's social media. Facebook, specifically. It's like the first thing I look at when I wake up. It's the last thing I look at before I go to bed.
So do you think you're addicted to Facebook?
I've been wondering this, you know, like, is this just a harmless pastime or is it something more serious? I went and talked to a researcher who studies social media and internet usage in Seattle. Her name is Dr. Megan Moreno.
I'm the principal investigator of the Social Media and Adolescent Health Research Team, also known as SMART or SMOT if you're from Boston.
You're from Wisconsin.
I am. So I should be making it SMART.
And she and her team are studying the effects of what they call problematic internet usage. And she sat me down in front of a computer to take this test.
Did she put you on BuzzFeed to take?
No. It's a serious diagnostic tool that doctors use to find out if adolescents are actually addicted, and it's a bunch of questions.
Do you have problems with face-to-face communication due to your internet use?
No, absolutely not.
Do you feel anxious because you're away from the internet?
Yeah, sometimes. Sometimes it's hard to be unplugged.
Yes, and so you can tell we're trying to get at this concept of almost like withdrawal. What kind of emotions do you feel when you're not able to access? And it's going to be different for different people.
18 questions in all, just like this.
So wait, I thought I heard her say she was studying adolescents.
Yeah, she is. But the medical definition of adolescent is broader than you might think. It's teenagers, basically from the onset of puberty, but all the way up through like age 25.
But does the research actually carry over to adults, grown, highly mature, evolved individuals like yourself?
Well, thank you, first of all. Maybe is the short answer. Adults are a little different than adolescents today, so the study might not completely carry over. For example,
the nice things that adults can bring to the table is, one, they have a complete frontal lobe, so usually they can have possibly a little more control. And second, they grew up in a time period that didn't have access to these wonderful toys. So they know what it's like to take a whole weekend and not go online. Whereas for an adolescent today, it's possible that in most of their memory, they've never had a weekend where they didn't have internet access.
Ah, that brings back such warm or conflicted memories, I guess. Okay, so Dr. Moreno and her team, what are they actually trying to figure out?
Essentially, they are less worried about how often teenagers use the internet. And the question is more like, are they neglecting their real-world responsibilities and relationships?
What our interest is in our research is, where does that cross the line to being a problem that should be on the radar of health providers?
See, I ask myself this all the time. Like, am I being healthy? Is this fine? Am I keeping in touch with old friends? Or am I kind of mindlessly, you know?
It's a great question. And if you look back in history, that's a question that a lot of people asked about television, for example. And so the early recommendations around television said, okay, this is a function of the number of hours. So if you watch television more than 6 hours a day, you are a problematic television viewer. But over time, what we realized is it's not just quantity, it's also quality. So if you're watching television 6 hours a day and you're watching Nova, then maybe that's not such a bad thing.
But here's the catch. It used to be easier to tell what was good and what wasn't, right? Nova does one thing on its entire program. A TV show full of violence does another thing. But Facebook is a mix of everything. You've got links from the Washington Post. You've got videos of cats. You've got people being mean to each other. Facebook is kind of one-stop shopping for all this different stimuli.
Now it's kind of like Target. You know, Facebook is the Target of the web. You can go there and get pretty much everything that you need. And even if you just stop by to get a sponge, you walk out with $200 worth of things. Facebook's the same way, right? You go on, you're meaning to just check messages, but you notice a lot of people liked your post, and then someone posted a link to an article that you want to read. So it satisfies a lot of different needs.
But I guess what strikes me is that, you know, if I'm a shopaholic, I can stay home from Target, but it's pretty hard to get away from the internet.
Right, right. It's everywhere in our modern lives, right? We're applying for jobs on the internet. We're checking our messages on the internet. And that has led a lot of physicians to really look at a different way of treating problematic internet usage. For example, there are ways to treat chemical addictions. There are ways to treat behavioral addictions, like gambling.
But there's another camp of people that have talked about problematic internet use as being more similar to an eating disorder.
And that insight, knowing what kind of vice a doctor is dealing with, that changes everything, Gabe.
How do we change someone's relationship with this substance so that they're able to use it for sustenance, but they're able to repair that unhealthy relationship?
Because just like an eating disorder, if the problem is your relationship with food, you can't quit food.
Exactly.
So if you can't get rid of the internet, or at least most of us can't, how do you actually treat an addiction to it?
BBC.
What do you mean, like Doctor Who?
Yeah, no, no, not the BBC. Balance, boundaries, and communication, BBC. Balance is things like whether you're still maintaining those in-person relationships with people, showing up for work, those kinds of things. Boundaries, what am I posting online? Would my grandmother be proud of it? And then communication, am I talking with my kids about the things that they're seeing and doing online? How are the things that they're seeing and doing online translating into the real world?
So Ed, how are you doing with your internet usage? How is your balance and boundaries and communication?
According to Dr. Moreno.
So even though you're logging onto Facebook multiple times a day.
I'm fine.
It sounds like your relationship with that is not affecting your work, your other relationships offline, or being able to get your daily jobs done.
What a relief. Thank you.
Yeah, but I have to ask you, Ed, I mean, don't we kind of get this conversation coming up every time there's a new technology? We get this kind of alarmist thing that people are going to get addicted to it. I mean, they must have thought, oh, the kids are going to be sitting around the phonograph all day. They're not going to do the chores.
I asked Dr. Moreno about it. She's actually looked into it.
So with the telephone, there were articles written that said, oh, this is going to revolutionize the way we communicate. It is going to be the downfall of women because men will be calling them and the women won't know who those men are, and they'll be able to lure them out to these places they shouldn't be. Mm-hmm. And then with radio, people wouldn't think about things objectively like they would with newspapers. They would be persuaded by voices and music.
Report to the nation from CBS World News. Tonight you'll hear John Lardner of Newsweek, just back from the Italian front. CBS reporter Eric.
Have we ever invented something as a society, a new technology that we interact with, where it's been, oh, that's fine, no big deal. This one worked exactly as we thought it would. There's no downside to this.
Maybe a blender.
Well, Ed Ronco, thank you so much for coming in and airing your not all that dirty laundry, really.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Hey, if you, like Ed, are wondering whether you are addicted to Facebook or any other online activity, you can see that actual quiz. Go to our website at kplusoundeffect.org. Imagine if a part of who you are was considered itself to be a vice. You know, not just something immoral, but something that you could overcome if you just worked hard enough at it. Well, that's the situation that a guy named Danny Cords found himself in when he came out as gay to his mom and dad at age 14. So Danny grew up in a very religious home in this kind of semi-rural setting in Renton, and the conversation with his parents about being gay did not go well. So his mom talked to a pastor, and he urged her to put Danny into something called conversion therapy. Now, what conversion therapy is, it's also called reparative therapy, is this program of counseling that's meant to get Danny to overcome this vice of his, the vice, of course, being homosexuality. And the implication of that is that you can turn from gay to straight. So Danny went to this therapy, once, sometimes twice a week for 3 years, and he's dealt with the consequences for many years after that. He came into our studio last week to tell us how it started.
So we had to go all the way to Tacoma to find this therapist who sat me down, and one of the first things that he wanted to figure out was whether I was a top or a bottom, which, of course, are sexual positions. And I was 14. I had no idea. I hadn't had sex. So I didn't know what to say. And then he wanted to figure it out. So it was incredibly uncomfortable.
Why did he want to know that? That's such a strange thing.
It is strange. It was through this theory, and he was very open about this, that if you're a top, then you are obviously on this level of heterosexuality in some form. Like, if you're a bottom, you're completely submissive.
So if you're a bottom, you're identifying more with a submissive, I see, or kind of, quote, feminized kind of a position.
Exactly.
And then there's no helping you at all? Or?
Well, it wasn't that there was no helping you. It's just that you would require more therapy and that they would have to really work at you, and you might have to go to some of the camps that they had back then or some of the workshops that they had.
What else did the therapy consist of?
It was fear-based. So there was a Bible verse, but basically something, something, you'll become the slums of the earth. And he asked me if I'd ever been to Capitol Hill once outside of a field trip. And he asked me if there were any homeless people there and drug addicts and whatever. And I said, yes. And he's like, well, there you go.
So tell me more about what happened in the sessions when you were given these sort of this homework and ways to try and change your behaviors. What kind of homework were you given?
So the motto of the therapy was all things are possible through Christ. So prayer. For me, it was this, what it meant for me was this pocket cross that came with a card, and you keep it in your pocket. And whenever you had temptations or bad feelings, you were supposed to grab it in your pocket and recite the prayer. You know, the more I think about this and the more I reflect on the pocket cross and what that meant for me, because I had it for years, is you hold it in your hand. And I think I kept my hand probably in my pocket on that cross for most of the day as a way for me to redirect focus to God away from whatever, musical theater. And then there was the rock in your shoe, which is, it was similar to the cross, but it was supposed to be that poking at you so that you didn't have to grab it and hold it and remember it, that it would do it for you, that you would always know, and you'd have that, not quite pain, but discomfort.
What was it supposed to make you think of?
For me as a kid, every day going through conversion therapy, I thought, felt, did all these things that I wasn't supposed to. Every moment was me. The rock in my shoe was trying to change that.
And was it variations on that theme that whole time for how long, like 3 years?
It was actually, so there was a lot of gloom and doom. And then there was a lot of talking about the Bible and talking about me and talking about the way I formed male relationships. But for this one in particular, it was more cognitive behavioral. So take a behavior, get to know what's behind it, and then change it.
The way that this made you think about yourself, did you believe it? Did you sort of buy into it?
The counselor was not very convincing. I was being confirmed in the Lutheran church at the time, and he would misquote the Bible. So I didn't believe him. But what did happen is that I didn't believe in myself anymore. Nothing mattered. And I really did stop caring about school, about friends. I isolated. I got incredibly depressed.
So while all this was going on, I mean, you had a lot of other challenges in your life, too. What was that like? What was your school like? What was your home life like as you're kind of struggling with your own sexual identity?
Sure. Well, I didn't explicitly come out in high school, but people are smart and they figure things out. So I was bullied quite a bit in school. So there would be times when I'd be in the lunchroom and somebody would spit on me and the lunchroom lady would see it and not do anything. Or, you know, I'd be followed, you know, followed home. We'd walk through the horse trails and people would follow me, yell at me, whatever. Or follow me in my car, tailgate me, flash their lights.
In the midst of all that, what was it about the therapy in particular that affected you as opposed to all this other stuff? I mean, you had kind of an us versus them thing in a lot of parts of your life.
Well, when you go to a therapy that becomes your entire life, and then you're bullied and your parents don't support what you want to do or be or who you are, then there isn't much point to living.
How did that progress for you, and your what was your state of mind like?
I eventually came to ends with my parents, and I left home at 17, my senior year of high school, and I was on my own, and it just got worse. As I lived and my life continued, I got more and more depressed. I knew that inside I was this hollow person, and so I one night just made a plan to end it and commit suicide.
What do you want to say about that?
Well, I think the most important thing to bring up when talking about suicide attempts is just that, and in relation to therapy, is that who I was taken from me that first week that I was in therapy. When you put it all together and you look at it holistically, you have parents who don't know what to do. They put you in therapy and they question who you are. What you are, and you start to question who you are, what you are, and no one has answers for you, and there's no role models. And then you go to school, and people bully you, and you're still receiving therapy, and your parents still don't know what to say, almost at no fault of their own. So it really muddies up where you find your value and where you find your self-worth. And so as I moved out and tried to find my way in the world at 18, 19 years old, it's almost a wonder I didn't do it sooner.
You made it. How did you emerge from that chapter?
Good question. Because I still suffer from brain damage from my attempted suicide. And I think that part of me died, that part of me that didn't value myself, that part of me that questioned myself, that part of me that worried about what somebody or some kind of therapy or therapist thinks about me.
What was it about the therapy that you feel like robbed you of your self-worth?
I mean, it's a lot of things. But mostly this concept of the way you dress, the way you talk, the way you like show tunes is wrong. That if you don't change, that it's your fault. And that somehow all things are possible through Christ, but Christ must not love you enough to do anything about it, even though you are praying constantly.
I guess finally, you've come to terms with your own parents' beliefs about this, and it sounds like you guys have repaired your relationship to a large extent. But what about parents who are going through this now? What would you say to them? What advice would you give to them, to a parent who's confronting this with their own kid?
So I want to first say that my parents are really good people. And I think that is really important to point out, because what they did out of ignorance and they did out of fear. So for parents, when their son comes out of the closet or daughter comes out of the closet, for whatever that closet may be, they need to sit down and take a couple deep breaths and really research and get out into the community. And whatever that means, online, I mean, we have the internet, it's wonderful. And to do your homework before you do anything, I mean, it's one of those hard things, because there's so much emotion and passion built into this and fear, but you have to look at it holistically. Otherwise, you can't make an informed decision.
Danny Cords was in conversion therapy from the age of 14 to 17, and now he advocates banning conversion therapy for minors. That is still legal in Washington state, and Danny testified before the legislature in favor of a bill that would outlaw it for minors last year. That bill is expected to be reintroduced this session. We have decided to give the last word to Danny and the group that he credits with helping him come into his own, the Seattle Men's Chorus. And here's a bit of Danny singing. It's from the production of I Am Harvey Milk. Sound Effect is produced by Arwen Nix and Kevin Kniestead. Special thanks to KPLU's Vice Squad, Ashley Gross, Ed Ronco, Nick Morrison, Sonny Crockett, and Ricardo Tubbs. Aaron Hennessy is our executive producer, and our online managing editor is Martha Kang. You can peruse our vast 5-week archive at kplusoundeffect.org. And we'd love to hear what you think of the show. You can tell us at soundeffect@kplu.org or just tweet at KPLU. Hey, meet me here in a week. We will be savoring second chances.
It's kind of exotic recycling.
I'm Gabriel Spitzer. This is 88.5 KPLU.